Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in the next half hour, we're going to continue with our examination of some of the circumstances surrounding America's political assassinations of the 1960s and 1970s. In the first half hour, we took a look at not only the exceedingly passive defense of James Earl Ray and the very strange role of an author named William Bradford Huey in that passive defense. We also took a look at a strange foreshadowing by William Bradford Huey in an August 1961 magazine article of some of the circumstances surrounding the official story of the assassination of President Kennedy. Note my qualification in that particular regard. What we're going to do now is to reprise an article with which I concluded the first half hour, this by way of establishing continuity. This is from the San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, November 22nd of 1999, the anniversary of President Kennedy's assassination. It's an AP story, Dateline Washington. Its headline, Papers Suggest Oswald Tape Survived. And it reads in part, hours after President John F. Kennedy was assassinated, FBI agents reportedly listened to a tape of a phone call that a man identifying himself as Lee Oswald, unquote, had placed to the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. They made a startling discovery. The voice on the tape was not Oswald, government records say. This controversial tape has been a question mark in the assassination investigation since Kennedy was killed. The assassination occurred 36 years ago today, and only now have new details about the tape come to light. The CIA said years ago that the tapes on which it recorded the call were erased. Documents released in recent years said otherwise. The latest and newest of declassified documents offer more evidence that the tape survived. The discovery that the voice on the tape was someone other than Oswald was a, quote, disquieting discovery because the man who impersonated Oswald was still at large, unquote, said John Newman, an ex-military intelligence analyst, author, and professor at the University of Maryland. Oswald was in Mexico City in September and October of 1963. During his one-week stay, he contacted the Soviet embassy and the Cuban consulate, inquiring about visas needed to go to the Soviet Union via Cuba. It was also known that while he was in Mexico City, Oswald had contact with Valery Kostikov. This should be allegedly had contact with Valery Kostikov, a man that one CIA memo described as a, quote, case officer in an operation which is evidently sponsored by the KGB's 13th Department, responsible for sabotage and assassination, unquote. It was the caller who is thought to have impersonated Oswald who links him to this Soviet spy unit. In RFA number 37, and also in For the Record segments 158 and 168, we went into various aspects of the attempts to link Lee Harvey Oswald to the communists, and the evidence suggests very strongly that fascist elements were involved in creating this disinformation, linking Oswald to the assassination of a Ukrainian fascist named Stefan Bandera. And again, we went into that in RFA program 15, RFA program 37, and also For the Record segments 158 and to a lesser extent in 168 as well. Note again, as Professor Newman has pointed out in that article, that this information is actually disinformation, and creating of an Oswald imposter in an attempt to link Oswald to the Soviet Union is what Professor Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor and researcher, has termed a Phase 1 cover-up, namely, the commies did it. The Phase 2 cover-up was that Oswald the lone nut did it because he couldn't get enough sex, etc., etc., etc. What we're going to do now is to take a look at the circumstances surrounding this alleged call between Oswald and alleged KGB operative Valery Kostikov in Mexico City. In order to learn more about this, we're going to take a look at a book by the aforementioned Professor Peter Dale Scott. It's called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. Again, authored by Peter Dale Scott, published in hardcover by the University of California at Berkeley Press, and actually University of California Press. Copyright 1993. The ISBN number is 0-520-08410-1. And again, bear in mind William Bradford Huey's role in creating the, foreshadowing the circumstances surrounding the cover story in the assassination of John F. Kennedy a good 2 years before it took place. Interesting, in light of his strange role in the investigation of the assassination of Martin Luther King. In Chapter 3, called The Dialectical Cover-Up, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows about some of the Mexico connections, and in particular, the alleged call to Valerie Kostikov by, quote, Lee Harvey Oswald. Peter Dale Scott writes, "Leads from Mexico were, in fact, the hidden key to what I have called the two-phase dialectical cover-up, in which Phase 1, a false but plausible story of an international communist conspiracy, supported by superficially credible evidence from intelligence sources too sensitive to be publicly disclosed, was eventually Phase 2 replaced by a second false story of Oswald as a lone assassin. Many who found the second false story much more implausible than the first, nevertheless came forward to support it as preferable, even if manifestly untrue, for reasons of state, the avoidance of an unnecessary and unjust war. The best, but as we shall see, not the only example of a plausible Phase 1 story from sensitive sources in Mexico is the following secret pre-assassination cable to CIA Director McCone on October 9, 1963, from Winston McKinley Scott, the CIA station chief in Mexico City." And this is paragraph 1, after deleted October 63, "American male who spoke broken Russian said his name was Lee Oswald, stated that he was at the Soviet embassy on September 28th when he spoke with consul, whom he believed to be Valery Vladimirovich Kostikov. Subject asked Soviet guard Ivan Obyedikov if there was anything new RE telegram to Washington. Obyedikov, upon checking, said nothing received yet, but request had been sent." Paragraph 2. "Have photos male appears to be American, long deletion. October 1st. Apparent age 35, athletic build, circa 6 feet, receding hairline, balding top, wore khakis and sport shirt. Source deleted." Paragraph 3. "No local dissemination." And the description, by the way, is obviously of someone other than Lee Harvey Oswald. Continuing, and Peter Dale Scott comments on this, "Today, few believe that the man in this cable was the 23-year-old from Dallas known to the world as Lee Harvey Oswald. Yet, whether he was or was not, we almost certainly have evidence of high-level intrigue. Kostikov has recently been identified by the CIA and FBI as a member of the KGB's 13th Department, responsible for sabotage and murder. Other CIA sources, as we shall see, were alleging that the KGB's 13th Department had a training school for assassins in Minsk, where Oswald had lived from 1959 to 61 as an apparent Marine defector. Just before the assassination, the FBI had intercepted a letter to the Soviet embassy dated November 9, 1963, and signed Lee H. Oswald. It referred to, quote, my meetings with Comrade Kostin in the embassy of the Soviet Union, unquote, and added the mysterious innuendo, quote, had I been able to reach the Soviet embassy in Havana as planned, the embassy there would have had time to complete our business, unquote. Although this letter might appear ambiguous to some, in the paranoid, anti-communist worldview espoused by James Jesus Angleton, the CIA's counterintelligence chief, the letter, quote, suggested that Oswald had been involved in some undercover dealings with Soviet officials in Mexico, Cuba, and Washington. The alleged Oswald Kostikov contact remains mysterious, if not sinister. Even as released by CIA Director Robert Gates in 1992, the Mexico City cable remains censored at certain points. The Warren Report, in its superficial treatment of Oswald's letter, reported the CIA's identification of Kostin, unquote, as Kostikov, but was understandably silent about the KGB's Department 13. The House Committee, as we shall see, also tiptoed around the implications of the Kostikov story. Right after the assassination, James Angleton's counterintelligence staff inside the CIA, sometimes referred to as a second or alternative CIA, unquote, suggested in a memo that the Oswald Kostikov, quote, connection might not be totally innocent, unquote. Peter Dale Scott goes on to comment, of course not. And yet a message from the CIA to the FBI on October 10th, the day after the cable, combined misinformation about, quote, Lee Henry Oswald, unquote, with astonishing silence about Kostikov, presumably the more important subject of inquiry. If the man we know as Oswald had, quote, business, unquote, with Kostikov, that business should have been investigated. If he did not, and above all, if an older and heavier man impersonated Oswald, we have evidence of a different conspiracy serving the Phase 1 needs for a cover-up to simulate an international communist conspiracy where none existed. Either way, the treatment of the story by the Warren Commission and the House Committee constitutes a cover-up, as some of their members and staff must have been aware. What they were covering up, however, was not necessarily a conspiracy of either variety, quote, communist, unquote, or Phase One, so much as an earlier cover-up of the Kostikov story by both the CIA and FBI before the Warren Commission had begun its business. The CIA never gave the Warren Commission all the data it had accumulated in response to the Mexico City cable about, quote, Lee Oswald, unquote, and Kostikov. What we do have suggests that the response of CIA headquarters at Langley was a cautious one. Their outgoing cable of notification the next day to State, the FBI, and the Navy was careful to speak like the incoming cable of a, quote, man who identified himself as Lee Oswald, unquote, who had said to a Soviet embassy guard that he had spoken with Kostikov 3 days earlier. Note that this was someone who claimed to be Oswald and who said he'd spoken with Kostikov. Continuing, this account clearly leaves room for the possibility that an imposter, not Oswald, was planting a false trail to the KGB. But a member of the CIA's Mexico City station turned this allegation into purported fact when he reported on October 16th that, quote, this officer, i.e. himself, determined that Oswald had talked with Kostikov, unquote. In other words, the officer reported the alleged Oswald's claim as fact, and if the alleged Oswald's claim was false, so was the officer's. And weigh this against the information, at least the allegation in that Chronicle article of 11-22-99, that the tapes still exist. Continuing, If, as I believe, the memo was part of a Phase One conspiracy to induce a cover-up, then the author of the memo was probably part of it. The name of the author is deleted from the censored versions released in 1976 and 1992, but seems to have appeared on the file copy. Almost certainly, the author was either CIA Station Chief Wynn Scott or CIA Officer David Phillips, both of whom are now dead. This is just one case where the release of all the files on the Kennedy case would give us important new information. Most critics now think the alleged Oswald was an imposter. The CIA, right after the assassination, sent to Dallas photos it claimed were of this man. Clearly, they are shots of someone heavy-set, balding, and middle-aged. Oswald was not heavy-set. His hair was thinning, but he was only 23, hardly middle-aged. Continuing, House Select Committee researcher Edwin Lopez studied all the CIA surveillance photos during Oswald's alleged visits to the Cuban embassy in this period and concluded, as he said later on television, that the visitor was not Oswald, but an imposter. This conclusion is reinforced by an FBI report about a CIA recording of the alleged Lee Oswald's voice. The report said that the Dallas FBI heard the recording and rejected it as not being of Oswald. The recording itself, an important possible clue to a conspiracy, apparently disappeared sometime after the assassination, and a solitary documentary reference to it did not reach any audience outside intelligence circles until 1975. Again, note the Chronicle article of 11-22-99, which alleges that that tape still apparently exists. Continuing, retired CIA officer David Phillips then claimed that the recordings of, quote, Oswald, unquote, in Mexico were destroyed prior to the assassination. But this claim is challenged by an FBI memo to the Secret Service of November 23, 1963, which was not released until a dozen years later. The Central Intelligence Agency advised that on October 1, 1963, an extremely sensitive source had reported that an individual identified himself as Lee Oswald, who contacted the Soviet embassy in Mexico City inquiring as to any messages. Special agents of this bureau, who have conversed with Oswald in Dallas, Texas, have observed photographs of the individual referred to above and have listened to a recording of his voice. These special agents are of the opinion that the above referred to individual was not Lee Harvey Oswald. One thus gets the impression that the CIA, possibly quite innocently, had both photographs and a voice recording of a conspirator, not Oswald, who was consciously inducing the future cover-up of the assassination of the president by laying a false or Phase One trail to the doorstep of the KGB's assassination bureau in Mexico City. Such a conspirator would, of course, be no maniac or societal outcast, unquote, as the lone assassin, unquote, Oswald has been depicted, but a sophisticated planner who is counting on the CIA's surveillance of the Soviet embassy in Mexico City to detect his reported contact with Kostikov. In 1963, such a person would almost certainly have had to be associated with the global intelligence milieu, or at least privy to special knowledge about the CIA's procedures. Richard Helms, then the CIA's deputy director for plans, took steps to dispel this impression so far as the photographs were concerned. In a belated explanation to the Warren Commission, which was itself withheld from the public until 1967, Helms assured the commission that the photograph was taken on October 4, 1963, 2 days after Oswald was supposed to have left Mexico City. He misleadingly neglected to mention that the other photographs of the heavyset man had been taken at the time of Oswald's visit and the alleged Oswald-Soviet embassy conversation. He gave the alternative impression that Oswald and the unidentified middle-aged man had only been confused ex post facto in some innocent CIA mix-up. Such an explanation could work for the photograph, since photos do not identify themselves. If the FBI report is correct, however, the recording could not have been sent by mistake. It recorded the voice of someone, apparently not Oswald, who identified himself as Lee Oswald, unquote. The House Committee's discussion of the Oswald Mexican seems determined to accept the misleading explanations offered by Helms and the FBI, quoting, "The overwhelming weight of the evidence indicated to the committee that the initial conclusion of agency employees that the individual was Oswald was the result of a careless mistake. It was not, the committee believed, because the individual was posing as Oswald." Obviously, this should be taken with a generous dose of salt. "In fact, the committee established, i.e. from Helms, that the photograph was not even obtained at a time when Oswald was reported to have visited the Soviet embassy in Mexico City." Italics added, "The committee did not add that other photographs of the heavyset man had been obtained at the time of Oswald's visit." In response to a committee inquiry, the FBI reported that no tape recording of Oswald's voice was in fact ever received. On November 25th, the Dallas office again apprised the director that, quote, "There seems to be some confusion in that no tapes were taken to Dallas," unquote. Finally, on the basis of an extensive file review and detailed testimony by present and former CIA officials and employees, the committee determined that CIA headquarters never received a recording of Oswald's voice. The committee concluded, therefore, that the information in the November 23, 1963 letterhead memorandum was mistaken and did not provide a basis for concluding that there had been an Oswald imposter. Obviously, this conclusion of the House Select Committees is wrong. Continuing, "The committee did not consider, let alone refute," this, by the way, is Peter Dale Scott commenting on that, "the committee did not consider, let alone refute, the common-sense possibility that the recording of Oswald's voice, instead of being taken to FBI agents in Dallas, was simply played to them by long-distance radio or telephone. Nor did it mention the testimony it received from Cuban Consul General Eusebio Azcu, A-Z-C-U-E, that the Oswald he encountered in the Cuban consulate, quote, in no way resembled, unquote, the Oswald he saw later in Dallas newsreel footage. The Oswald who made a scene at his consulate was, quote, maybe 35 years old, unquote, and with an unyouthful," again quoting, "deeply lined face," unquote. Supporting Askew's allegation that the Oswald in his office was not the Dallas Oswald is the fact that the CIA had arranged to photograph surreptitiously all visitors to the Soviet embassy and Cuban consulate on a routine basis. As the committee noted, that, of course, is the House Select Committee on Assassinations, quote, "Oswald paid at least 5 visits to the Soviet embassy or the Cuban consulate," unquote. Yet the CIA could not come up with even one photo that resembled the Dallas Oswald, at the same time that they had to explain the 6 or more photographs they possessed of the heavyset man. The committee's explanation, quote, "photographs of Oswald might have been taken and subsequently lost or destroyed," unquote, might allay suspicions in the case of someone in whom the CIA had no interest. But, quote, Lee Oswald, unquote, was supposed to have met with Kostikov, a KGB agent from Department 13 dealing with sabotage and assassination. A committee staff report by Edwin Lopez, still not released, confirms how sensitive the matter was. According to someone who has seen it, the staff report established that, on the death of Wynn Scott, the by-then-retired Mexico City station chief who had sent out the Kostikov cable, CIA counterintelligence chief Angleton, flew immediately... According to someone who has seen it, the staff report established that, on the death of Wynn Scott, the by-then-retired Mexico City station chief who had sent out the Kostikov cable, CIA counterintelligence chief Angleton flew immediately to Mexico City, retrieved a photograph of, quote, Oswald, unquote, from the family safe, and destroyed it. This staff report, said to run to 300 pages, is an example of important file information on the assassination that deserves to be released. Angleton may have undertaken this mission on behalf of the agency. Another possibility is that he undertook it on behalf of a cabal within the government who had conspired to create the, quote, Oswald, unquote, Kostikov story. Later, we shall look at other indications of a cabal linking CIA officer David Phillips, Wynn Scott, James Angleton, who handled for the CIA the supposed Kostikov link to the Kennedy assassination, and Angleton's FBI friend and colleague William Sullivan, who during World War II had directed Wynn Scott's intelligence work in Mexico and Latin America for the FBI. So again, there's certainly... appears to have been considerable official dissembling with regard to this, quote, Oswald, unquote, who was basically attempting to lay a false trail of misinformation, or a false trail leading to the Soviet Union and or Cubans with regard to the assassination of President Kennedy, this a considerable time before the assassination itself. And again, note that the Mexican connection figures very prominently in the JFK assassination investigation, and note that William Bradford Huey, the same fellow who was so instrumental in effecting the solicitation of the guilty plea from James Earl Ray, and who attempted to do the same thing prior to the as the House Select Committee on Assassinations was forming, William Bradford Huey was laying down information pointing into Mexico of a good 2 years, 2+ years before the assassination. What conclusion exactly one draws from that remains to be seen, but certainly William Bradford Huey is a very interesting individual, and he may very well have had some inside information about many of these events. Still later in Deep Politics and the Death of JFK, Peter Dale Scott links some of the people involved in some of this Mexico City disinformation about the Oswald Kostikov KGB connection to later cabals involving drug trafficking and elements of U.S. intelligence. By the way, the DFS here stands for the Federal Security Directorate, and Miguel Nazar Haro was one of the key people involved with that, and many, many years ago in this program I covered the deep-sixing of an indictment of Miguel Nazar Haro for numerous crimes because of his connections to U.S. intelligence. And some of the deep politics involving drug trafficking, elements of U.S. intelligence, and a milieu that runs all the way back to the events of the fall of 1963 that we've just been talking about, Peter Dale Scott writes as follows. It would emerge that the Federal Security Directorate, or DFS, an agency created out of the Gobernación Secretariat in the 1940s, was PRI's chief link to the highly institutionalized Mexican drug traffic. Through it, Alberto Cecilia Falcón and other high-level traffickers acquired official cards identifying them as agents of the Gobernación. The PRI, by the way, is the dominant political party of Mexico. Continuing. According to Elaine Shannon, quote, most DEA agents who worked in Mexico and on the border considered the DFS the private army of the drug traffickers. They called the DFS badge, quote, a license to traffic, unquote. At the same time, DFS was the chief point of contact for both CIA and FBI officials with the Mexican government. When the DFS chief, Miguel Nazar Haro, was secretly indicted by a U.S. grand jury in San Diego for his participation in North America's largest stolen car ring, the CIA blocked the indictment because of Nazar Haro's, quote, indispensability as a source of intelligence in Mexico and Central America, unquote. One is struck by the recurring importance of this U.S.-protected Mexican Gray Alliance as a source of disinformation both before and after November 1963 about Oswald and the JFK murder. Nazar Haro was a longtime personal friend of the CIA's Mexican station chief, Wynne Scott, to the extent of giving him a Cadillac for his own use. And Wynne Scott's station, in turn, played a key role in the transmission of false stories about Oswald in Mexico. The Gobernación of Mexico also transmitted a number of altered or suspicious documents on Oswald, such as the forged bus manifest and the list of tourist cards which suppressed the name of William Goday. By the way, he also traveled on the same trip to Mexico as Lee Oswald and had connections to U.S. intelligence. Continuing. As we shall see in the next chapter, Noe Palomares, the Gobernación official transmitting these documents, was also connected indirectly to witnesses implicating Oswald in a Phase 1, unquote, communist conspiracy. And Bernardo de Torres, a Cuban exile drug trafficker with intimate links to Nazar Haro, became, in 1966 and 7, a source of dubious reports about Miami for the Garrison investigation. By the way, Bernardo de Torres also has been named in connection with the assassination of Orlando Letelier as well. The role of Bernardo de Torres as an infiltrator into Jim Garrison's investigation is covered in the marvelous new book about the Garrison investigation entitled Let Justice Be Done, subtitled New Light on the Jim Garrison Investigation by William Davy, that's D-A-V-Y, published in soft cover by Jordan Publishing and Copyright 1999. It's a wonderful book, and there's an interview with Bill Davy available from Spitfire in For the Record segments 190. I've alluded to Spitfire. That's a tape duplication service which stocks the various tapes that I've recorded over the years. They can be reached by regular mail at Spitfire, one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. There are lists of and description of the various tapes available from Spitfire, both on the Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com, that's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T.com, and on the KFJC website at kfjc.org, look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs sections. The Spitfire website is equipped with real audio, so you can hear the For the Record segments going out to the stations that carry this program the week they're going out. And the KFJC website is also equipped with audio so that people can listen to the longer show that I do on KFJC, which is from 7 to 10 on Sunday night Pacific time, also 6 to 7 on Thursday night Pacific time. People can reach me by email at demory@kfjc.org. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. And please note that I do not have time to answer even emails, so please don't be offended if I don't get back to you. That concludes this half-hour segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.